Good morning again. I'd like to again state on the record, but for this case as well, that Judge Ryan will be participating on the record as a fifth judge in this case. I'd also like to specially welcome our guests from Dills. Welcome to the court, and we look forward to visiting with you today. Okay, the court now calls U.S. v. Jones.
Chief Judge Baker, members of the Honorable Court, Captain Jeff Davis, along with Colonel Patrick Wells, who represent the appellant, Lieutenant Jones.
Can you hear in the back? Okay, thank you. You're good.
The threshold matter, Your Honors, appellant's position is that the de facto officer doctrine does not apply to this case because that doctrine, the Supreme Court has consistently said, applies when there is merely a technical deficiency in the appointment, not when there is a constitutional structural defect. In this case, we're dealing not with...
Where do they say that?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Where do they say that?
Your Honor, I would start with the most recent case of United States v. Wynn.
Wynn?
Do you just want me to cite or I can... It says, typically we have found judges' actions to be de facto, have been to be valid de facto when there is merely a technical defect in the statutory authority. And then they continue to ignore a violation of the designation statute, in this particular federal statute, not a constitutional violation per se, would incorrectly suggest some action or inaction on petitioners could create authority Congress has quite carefully withheld, even if the parties had expressly stipulated the participation of a non-Article III judge in the consideration of the appeal, no matter how distinguished or well-qualified the judge might be. Such a stipulation then not cures plain defect in the composition of the panel. And they cite for the authority the Freytag, which itself cites Glidey. In both cases, essentially say the same thing. So in Freytag, which cites Glidey, it said Glidey expressly includes appointment clause objections to judicial officers in the category of non-jurisdictional structural constitutional objections that could be considered an appeal whether or not they were ruled on below.
What's an example of a technical defect, and what's the opposite of a technical defect for our analysis? If it's on the one hand, on the other hand, we have technical defect or...
Understood, Your Honor. I'll try to give you a couple of examples. The only cases I can find, at least from the Supreme Court, where they have applied the de facto officer doctrine were the very, very early cases. So McDowell, for example, is one where it appears a properly appointed Article III judge is appointed to a different circuit than what he was appointed to. And they said this inter-circuit judge stuff doesn't concern us, even if there was some paperwork that needed to be signed.
So that's an example of a technical defect or whatever is in that category.
I think so. And what I would point out in, I think it's Ryder itself, talks about McDowell. And I think in some sense does talk about the difference. And so in Ryder, it says the court further observed, that McDowell's claim presents a mere matter of statutory construction. It involves no trespass upon the execution of the power of appointment. And so I think that certainly is the contrary. And those early cases of the inter-circuit appointments are some of the only examples we come with the Supreme Court anyway. And I say that because, as I cited in my brief, there actually are very, very few Supreme Court cases in which they've actually ever applied that I can find. The de facto officer doctrine seems to be extremely rare. In fact, it has never occurred whenever they've found what they view to be a significant constitutional violation.
So in your view, on the other hand, we have something that interferes with the power of appointment, but that's not necessarily the entire universe.
Yes, understood, Your Honor. I think certainly there are...
Is that a fair statement of your position?
It is. And I would note, interestingly, from the Wynn case from 2013, that case didn't even arise to the level of constitutional violation, and yet the Supreme Court still found that they weren't going to apply the de facto officer doctrine. The violation in Wynn was simply a federal statute. And there's actually a footnote in Wynn that kind of references that. And it is, bear with me. Not finding the exact footnote, but what the footnote says is, we know that petitioners also argue a constitutional issue of appointments clause. But the Supreme Court says we don't have to reach that because the federal statute is good enough for us. So simply a violation, a direct violation of a federal statute, that'll stop us enough. And obviously, the opponent argues, as between a federal statute violation and a constitutional violation, the constitutional violation is, of course, much higher.
No, of course, in Ryder, the Supreme Court talked about a doctrine as if, you know, in certain cases it might apply. Of course, Ryder is very close to this case.
Yes, Your Honor.
So if it really doesn't apply in cases like this, why'd they go to the trouble of discussing it?
So I take it, Your Honor, and I would concede and agree with you, the court in Ryder, the language they use is they say...
They talk about...
Petitioner challenged...
Challenged. They talk about when they challenged it. Yeah.
If they've challenged it below, he's entitled to a decision on the merits.
Right.
Therefore, the de facto officer doesn't
right.
apply. I concede they said that, but they also said, and I think it's essentially the exact same paragraph, and his claim, that meaning Ryder's claim, is based on the Appointments Clause of Article 2 of the Constitution, a claim that there has been a trespass upon the execution of power. And then they distinguish that from McDowell. So they say both. And I guess I don't think you can conclude.
Well, are you essentially saying that they said that because they did this, you know, they're entitled to a decision on the merits, regardless of de facto, but even if they hadn't? Yeah.
I think that's what they're getting at. It's easy for them to say, since he challenged it,
since
below,
he did,
he clearly qualifies.
Right.
But we're not saying if you didn't, you wouldn't.
As a matter of law.
We'll just decide this on the easiest option we have. The easiest option is he argued it below, so he gets it above as well. But they also did say we're not foreclosing the idea that he still could have, even if he hadn't challenged below, because it was an appointments clause constitutional defect.
Mm-hmm.
So they do use the language that they qualify.
Okay. How do you answer the government's collateral direct attack argument that somehow what's being done here is collateral and that therefore the failure to object below kills it?
I appreciate you asking that, Your Honor. I think there's some confusion with this issue because the term, as I see it, collateral attack, it's used differently in some case law, differently than what the government's using it. So the government does cite that in the brief, and they say prompt challenges conferred upon proper form are particularly important because the de facto officer doctrine distinguishes between collateral attacks and direct attacks. Now they cite authority for that as Horowitz versus the State Board of Medical Examiners. It's 822F2D1508. That's a 10th Circuit case from 1987. Now, I do have to apologize. I did do some last-minute case checking. I literally was down in the basement during the first argument. So I went back to see where this was coming from.
Did you hold a moot court down there as well?
It was just me, Your Honor, so I'm sure it won't be very good. But I was looking at the case to see what's the 10th Circuit citing for this position, because every Supreme Court case you look at doesn't talk about the distinction. So the Horowitz case cites to a case called Lauer, Andreas versus Lauer. It's 792 F2D 1475, and it's a D.C. Circuit case from 1984. Is what Horowitz cites as authority for this distinction. And the D.C. Circuit case itself cites another D.C. Circuit case. It's called Greeting Card. So, as an initial matter, none of them are citing any Supreme Court case law to support this. But when you actually look at the Lauer case, which Horowitz is citing for authority, it essentially says it's not a good doctrine and that there should be cautious to apply it. And in fact, in Lauer, it was not even applied. And so what they said is, it should be noted that the case law in general is at best spotty and ambiguous concerning the scope and current validity of the doctrine. The greeting card case, which is what Lauer cites as the one that started this whole thing, is the only recent case that has mentioned the doctrine. In that case, it's a brief two-paragraph.
By the doctrine, do you mean de facto, or do you mean this collateral direct?
Collateral versus direct.
Distinction.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
That they decided the case on other grounds, and they gave only two brief paragraphs. The puzzling comment that a direct attack is an appropriate means of challenging the alleged qualifications, coupled with a footnote that cited cases that suggested that a direct attack is not an inadequate remedy. So it's a clearly, you know, greeting card is questionable, you know, authority. And then it also says, in a footnote, a greeting card itself, the opinion, this court suggested that Williams, which is another case, may have been correct and that such alleged direct and indirect challenges may be permissible. And as I said, the Lauer case, the D.C. Circuit, didn't even apply the doctrine.
Well, and that all begs the question of why this is collateral and not direct. It's in the context of an appeal on the case itself. We're not talking habeas or anything else like that here.
I agree, Your Honor. I think if I understand what you're saying correctly, my understanding of how the term or phrase collateral attack has been used, particularly by this court, and I think one example is the Elliott case, which this court cited in the grant order, is a collateral attack is an attack when you don't raise the issue below, and then on appeal, you're not talking about any merits of the case.
To me, that doesn't sound like collateral. That sounds like waiver. And, you know, it's either waived or it's not.
I mean, I agree. I'm not. I think it's.
Anyway, go ahead.
I think what I would say with the distinction as a bottom line.
Why don't you tell us why you think this is collateral or direct or not?
I don't think there's a meaningful distinction.
Okay.
Is what I would say at the end of the day.
In this case.
In this case, yes. And the reason for that is, at least with respect to the timing and the nature of the challenge, those two elements are essentially the same as in Ryder. In Ryder, it wasn't challenged below, it was challenged for the first time before the Supreme Court. That's true here. In Ryder, it was a direct challenge on the judge's ability or his appointment to sit on that panel.
Therefore, Ryder is controlling in your view.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe it is. There's no meaningful distinction between this case and Ryder. Clearly, there are factual differences. The Ryder case is a federal statute violation. Here, it's a constitutional violation. That's a difference, but it's a difference without meaning for our purposes because a constitutional violation is more significant than a federal statute violation. And that's not anything new in Ryder. That's the same position they took in Freytag. It's the same position they took in Glidden. And I'll be very candid with the court. You can look at those opinions and see that they were 5-4. And Justice Rehnquist and Justice Scalia made strong dissenting opinions in those cases. But since...
On the timing issue?
Yes. I mean, I think when you look at Scalia and Rehnquist's dissent, they would just say de facto officer doctrine is just a fancy word for waiver, which honestly is probably true. But since the last 25, 30 years that Scalia has been on the dissent, he's never been able to command a majority. And so although the people sitting on the court have changed, Ryder's still good law. And it's still based on probably close to 80 years or 100 years of precedent saying effectively that these structural defects that are of constitutional nature are not going to be waived, at least not in all cases anyway, as a matter of course. Because they weren't way below, we're going to hear them because, and I think the easiest answer is, and they say it in Ryder, more fundamentally, our enforcement of the statute is not driven so much by our concern for the validity of petitioner's conviction at trial, but rather for the validity of the composition of the Court of Appeals. So if I try to make an analogy, it's almost like a parent unlawful command influence. We don't care so much about him per se. We care about the process. We care about the constitutional framework of our government. And when we have actions that are violating the Constitution, those are significant enough for us to hear on the first time on appeal in these type of cases. It's essentially, they are saying they're treating it like jurisdictional error. It's what they said repeatedly in Wynn, Freytag and in Ryder. And I mean, the best example really is in Freytag, because in that case, the petitioners literally consented on the record to the participation of this judge, and never objected even after it until it got to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said, even still, with a verbal consent on the record, we're not going to find waiver, and we're not going to apply the de facto officer doctrine, because it's not appropriate. So, you know, clearly we're even better in this case, because there's at least no on-the-record waiver. And Ryder says it's exactly the same. They could expressly waive, and we could care less. The judge could be the most qualified judge that there is available, and we could care less. They even noted in Freytag, there was an argument, I know I have about 5 seconds, I'll finish. The government tried to argue an oral argument. Well, the president actually consented to this. He said it was okay, and it wasn't an encroachment on his authority. And the court said, we don't care. That's not how it works. And so that's how far they were willing to go. I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government, please.
Good morning, Chief Judge Baker, members of the court. May it please the court, I'm Captain Richard Schreider, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Catherine Oler, I represent the United States in this matter. The court should apply the de facto officer doctrine in this case because appellant failed to challenge the composition of the CCA panel that reviewed his case, even though he had multiple opportunities to do so.
Well, are you just saying it's waived? Or is applying the de facto officer doctrine a fancy way of saying it's waived?
Yes, sir. And if not waived, absolutely forfeited in this case. In particular,
just to be clear, there are two issues. One is whether there was a technical defect or something greater, and what does greater mean? Are you stipulating or agreeing that whatever occurred in this case is more than a technical defect and implicates the appointments clause, and therefore you're arguing timeliness and waiver, or are you saying that's just the better of my arguments?
Well, Your Honor, I think there's a little bit of a nuance in the argument there. Those, I do believe, are two different and distinct concepts. But as the, I think it's the dissent in the Wynn case, where Chief Judge Rehnquist authored the dissent, they actually discuss it somewhat and say, well, we're going to, we would apply plain error. But even if we were to look at this in a constitutional lens, constitutional issues could still be forfeited and subject to a plain error review. So I think through really...
But subject to plain error.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think that would be, it's appropriate in this case with these sets of facts and circumstances, plain error review would be entirely appropriate. We're dealing with a situation where the appellant was put on notice that Judge Soibel, the improperly appointed judge on the CCA panel, twice reviewed, was on a panel that reviewed appellant's case. And notably, the second time the panel, including Judge Soibel, reviewed appellant's case, 2 months afterwards, appellant actually took the time to file a motion for reconsideration, but did not raise the panel composition issue even at that time, and instead waited until he was filed.
Did he knowingly waive it, or he didn't spot it?
Well, if it wasn't waived, it was forfeited by the fact that he didn't raise it at that time.
And the TJAC didn't spot the issue, neither did the Secretary of Defense, apparently.
That is correct, Your Honor. And as this Court noted in its written opinion in the Jansen case, this was a novel issue. It was a case of first impression. And that, I think, is important here when you're looking at all the factors that would weigh towards applying the de facto officer doctrine. This isn't a situation where...
At what point, in your view, should the appellant, not as a legal argument, but as a practical matter, have been on notice that the Soibel appointment was an issue?
I think at the earliest, you could look to when the CCA issued the sua sponte notice of reconsideration and said, we're going to look at these 50 or 40 odd cases again. That certainly is a flag.
And when did that occur?
That occurred, it was... in early 2013, I don't have the exact date, but it would have been 23 May 2013, Your Honor. And so I think at a conservative view, that would have been...
When was Jones notified of the appointment by SecDef of Soible to the court, and when was he notified that Soible would be sitting on his panel again?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, the SECDEF appointed Judge Soible on 25 June.
And when was Jones notified of that?
Jones, he was notified. I don't know exactly when he was notified.
Was there a notice that went out?
I do not think that's in the record, Your Honor.
Was there a notice that went out that Soible was going to sit on his panel again before the decision was issued?
Your Honor, it was the same day as the decision. So, admittedly, there was not a lot of notice on the 23rd of July when he was given a panel notification.
So the only opportunity he had to complain was after the CCA had ruled?
Yes, Your Honor. And that actually goes to, similar to the situation in Elliott, where, of course, in the distinct facts there, but the third newly appointed judge hadn't even participated. Subsequently, you know, the panel issued its written decision in appellant's case, and then subsequently he took the oath. And at that point, it became known to appellant. So at some point here, the issue became known to appellant.
But this is all depending on adopting the dissenting perspective from the Supreme Court cases. Is that true or not true?
I think it's not true to the extent of, if you read through the majority's opinion, even in the majority of both Ryder and Wynn, they discuss, they bring up the de facto officer doctrine and they say, you know, plain error review. We're going to decline to look at this through plain error review for the following reasons. And in Ryder, they say, because the issue was challenged, the appellant challenged the composition of the CCA while at the CCA, and there's no indication that the CMA, that this court reviewed for plain error or looked at harm. And in Wynn, they, of course, didn't get to, they said, we're not going to apply the plain error review here because it was such a, essentially a flagrant disregard for some existing framework, some existing statutory language.
Well, flagrant disregard, but it was ultimately a statutory issue.
Yes, sir.
He's an Article 4 judge. He's sitting on an Article 3 panel. They could have reached the Appointments Clause, but they found it unnecessary. Here, you've got a stronger case, don't you? You've got a fundamental constitutional defect, ab initio, in the appointment of Soible. They tried it twice. They screwed it up twice. He's not a judge. You know, it's like me walking over the D.C. Circuit and plopping down on the bench.
Yes, Your Honor. And admittedly, from a starting point, all of the cases involving a de facto officer doctrine or referencing it, the starting point is there was an error. Somebody was in a position that they were improperly put in. And this entire doctrine...
Okay, but what I'm saying is this just isn't a, you know, garden variety error. He's not sitting on the wrong panel. He's not sitting on the Third Circuit when he was appointed to the Fourth Circuit. His appointment is constitutionally void.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so where's that leave us?
Well, and recognizing this court's decision in Jansen, he was improperly appointed. It is still, nonetheless, there's no de facto officer playbook that any court can look to and say, well, it's a bright line rule when we apply it or when we don't. And there are good reasons to apply it here. And one of the reasons is because Judge Soible, while improperly appointed, was unquestionably qualified for the position.
The Supreme Court explicitly didn't reach that in Ryder, the footnote in Ryder. I mean, you know, I don't care if Soible was Charles Evans Hughes. His appointment was constitutionally void. I mean, you know, I don't think has the de facto officer doctrine ever gone off the tracks to the extent that a court has held, well, he was improperly appointed, but he's a real good guy, so we'll give de facto validity to what he did. That's what you're saying.
I think it's absolutely part of what I'm saying. And Your Honor, to answer the direct question, no, I'm not aware of any cases where the Supreme Court has gone that far and said, constitutional issue, it's fine, we've got this de facto officer doctrine.
Okay.
It is clear that the de facto officer doctrine is a tool to be rarely used, and absolutely the government agrees with that. But I think all of these factors do come into play Because as the coming from the dissent in Nguyen, things can still be forfeited. In the appellate world, the what is just as important sometimes as the when. And here, appellant was made aware of an issue at some point. He waited until his case was presumably before this court to raise it.
Okay, didn't they do that in Freytag? Didn't they do that in Glidden v. Zdanok? And the Supreme Court took him anyway and didn't apply this doctrine.
Well, he didn't. Are you saying he waited until he got before this court? He tried to have it reconsidered at the lower court.
He did try to have his...
In theory, once he found out that Soybel was once again sitting on his case.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think...
And you're here saying, not good enough.
Well, I think it's important to look at why he asked for the reconsideration. He asked for reconsideration and raised the substance of that recon motion was based on it in the military judge's instruction issue, one of the five issues he had previously raised, and then he brought up some Moreno credit. There was nowhere was panel constitution or any challenge made to this present issue at any point before he filed a petition for grant of review with this court. And waiting and keeping a bullet in the chamber is exactly the kind
Wait,
of
Wait, he didn't do an out-of-time motion for reconsideration?
Your Honor, it's my understanding that the out-of-time motion for reconsideration was not based on this issue. And
Appellant will be able to decide whether we'll be able to raise it one way or the other.
Okay. Counsel, you're talking about there are good reasons to invoke the de facto officer doctrine here. Doesn't that point out that, in fact, even if we were to find that this fits within those rare instances where the Supreme Court has applied the de facto officer doctrine, we are not mandated to apply it?
I agree with that. Yes, Your
Honor. It's strictly within our discretion to determine whether it's appropriate.
Absolutely. Yes, Your Honor.
And so beyond the fact that you say that Judge Soybel was an effective judge and so forth, what, in your view, would be the compelling reasons about why we should apply the de facto officer doctrine in this particular case?
Your Honor, I think there are really four major reasons. Number one, appellant didn't make a timely challenge, and I know we've discussed that a little bit here, but... number two, Judge Soybel was qualified for the position. He had held the position before. Article 66 allows for civilians to be appointed.
Okay, but beyond those two points.
Beyond those two, really the degree of the error that occurred here.
We're talking about a constitutional appointments violation. When you say the degree of error, doesn't that actually cut extremely strongly against the government's position?
It does, Your Honor. And I think if there were any error analysis applied, the best viewpoint I can give is either a plain error view or harmless beyond reasonable doubt, something along that nature. You still would have to, looking at appellants, these unique facts and circumstances of this narrow set of cases, or this case in particular, it was an issue of first impression. Notwithstanding the decision here in Janssen, it was based on a good faith belief that Secretary of Defense had authority to appoint the judge. And realizing now that is an incorrect position.
You said there are four reasons. What's the fourth?
The fourth is that the application of the doctrine would not expand the doctrine in any way, shape, or form, as is necessary in all cases discussing the de facto officer doctrine.
Well, now, wait a minute. It wouldn't expand the doctrine. Where has it been appointed to? Where has it been applied to a constitutional infirmity in the appointment?
I am not aware of any situation.
Well, then, wouldn't it expand it? If it has never been applied to a constitutional infirmity in the appointment, then doesn't the potential application of it expand it?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
And I think it is still important to go back and it was one of the questions that I think you had asked appellant's counsel earlier, is the fact that it is still being discussed at the Supreme Court in cases like Ryder and Nguyen doesn't rule it out. It still, I think, is...
Policy consequences at stake here? Are there a lot of cases which would be affected by this, or is this a one-off? Why is the government fighting so hard on this?
Your Honor, I think to answer the first part of your question, It's my understanding there are approximately 7 cases that are for similarly situated appellants that did not challenge.
7?
I think it's 7, Your Honor. I'm not entirely sure, but I think that's roundabout.
What is the government's interest, legal interest here, and then what's the principle of law that is fundamental to being upheld for the government? Other than, you know, it's United States v. appellant, so you're on this side and the appellant's on that side, but is there some principle at stake that's pivotal?
Well, I think the broad concept that's at issue for the government would be, this is exactly, you know, holding on to an issue that you're aware of and waiting to raise it, you know, forfeiting the issue and waiting until the next higher court to raise it, is this exactly the sort of piecemeal litigation that this court has discouraged and that appellate courts in general have discouraged.
So that's the broader principle at stake in this case, from your standpoint?
Yes, Your Honor.
Beyond the fact of this or that?
Since we decided Janssen, the Supreme Court decided a case called Noel Canning, which is an appointments clause case. It actually had to do with the president's recess appointment power. But for our purposes, the Supreme Court held that the president's exercise of that power to appoint members of the National Labor Relations Board was not constitutionally done. The upshot of that one was that hundreds of cases decided by the purported National Labor Relations Board were junked, and they had to go back and over and redo them. There is not one mention in Noel Canning of the de facto officer doctrine. One would think that if prudential considerations had anything to do with it, that'd be the kind of case where they'd at least talk about it. They didn't. I mean, I'm throwing this at you, but what's your reaction to that?
Well, Your Honor, admittedly, I'm not as familiar with the I'm aware of the case, but not familiar with all of the facts at issue. Yes, I've heard that there was obviously no discussion of the de facto officer doctrine in that opinion, in that decision. But at the same time, they didn't say the de facto officer doctrine is dead.
Maybe it wasn't raised.
And I'm not sure whether the government had asked the Supreme Court to analyze it.
I don't either.
To incant it or apply it. So I guess I would just leave it there, Your Honor, of not sure what to make of it.
Good enough.
That's a fair response.
And if I may briefly conclude.
Of course.
The United States asks this court to apply the de facto officer doctrine and affirm the findings and sentence adjudged in appellant's case, which was reviewed by a panel of qualified, albeit unchallenged, appellate judges. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the appellant, you have the opportunity for rebuttal.
Your Honor, to answer the question that came up, I would concur with appellate counsel that in the motion for reconsideration out of time to FCCA, I do not believe that appellant re-raised anything regarding Soybean as the other issue. So
thank you.
I concur with that. What I'd like to start with is going back to Ryder, and this piggybacks on the question that came up. Because the whole issue of, hey, didn't raise it below, he's raising it now, should we hear it, it's going to cause problems with the appellate practice. And that's been, you know, addressed on numerous occasions, but I didn't myself know the numbers, but it turns out they were exactly the same in Ryder. So when they brought this issue up in Ryder, they said, there is not the sort of grave disruption or inequity involved in awarding retrospective relief to the petitioner in this case for the de facto officer doctrine. The parties agree that the effective appointment of a civilian judge only affects between 7 and 10 cases pending. And they say, look, that's not going to rise to the level of the concern that we're worried about with proper appellate practice. And so it looks like we're looking at roughly the same number of cases. Interestingly, it's far fewer cases that were involved in all the recon regarding what we might call Soybean 1 or Soybean 2 when it was a challenge on direct review. Those were like 30-some cases. And also, I could go back to Gwydion, deals with the same issue. And the court agrees that they're balancing this, but they said, at most, and this is in Zidane, at most is weighed in opposition to disruption to sound appellate process entailed by entertaining objections not raised below. This is plainly insufficient to overcome the strong interest of the federal judiciary in maintaining the constitutional claim of separation of powers. So they do weigh those factors, but when it's not merely a technical error, when it's a constitutional defect, particularly of appointments clause, which is a very, you know, robust part of the constitutional separation of powers, it's going to lose out, essentially, is what the court has consistently said. So that issue has been addressed, and the court said the same in Ryder as well. I don't have anything further to add. If the court has no questions, then I'll rest on the arguments.
The court has no further questions. We thank both counsels for your argument, and the court will stand in recess until further order of the court. Thank you.